Welcome to your At Percussion episode number 191. Today is August 11th. Today with me, as always, is Casey Cangelosi.
Hey, everyone. Sorry I'm sick. You guys have to listen to me with a sick voice. I think for at least the second time on the show, maybe more, it's that daycare. Robin, like you're holding him and he looks at you like he's going to kiss you or say something to you and just coughs right in your mouth, literally.
It's pretty... Get some Lysol wipes for that kid.
That's cute. And
then we have a couple of sort of guest co-hosts today, previous guests on the podcast, friends of the podcast, Caleb Pickering.
Hey, what's going on, dude?
And Bill Schultes.
How's it going?
I'm doing well. How are you, Bill?
I'm doing well, Ben. How was your summer?
It was good. You getting ready for the new school year?
Yeah, we don't start until the 26th. Just got back from New Hampshire. Actually spent a few weeks with Matt Sherrick and Megan Arnes as well, so...
Nice.
It was fun. Yeah.
All sorts of podcast friends here.
That's right. Well,
our guest today is Cameron Leach. Cameron is one of the most exciting young voices in percussion, having appeared internationally in the United States, Canada, Europe, and Asia. He's the winner of the Percussive Arts Society International Solo Artist Competition and the Yamaha Young Performing Artist Competition, and was awarded the prestigious performer certificate from the Eastman School of Music. He performs in the Northern California-based Orphic Percussion Quartet and is one half of the Leach Peters Percussion Duo, and he recently announced an upcoming performance of the Jennifer Higdon Percussion Concerto with the Dallas Winds under Jerry Junkin. So welcome to the podcast, Cameron Leach.
Thank you guys for having me.
What's new, Cameron? How's it going?
It's good, man. I just finished playing an alumni lacrosse game, so if I look a little red in the face and I start sweating profusely, that would be the reason why. And I'm pretty sure I broke some ribs, but it's fine. The fingers are intact, so we're good.
So lacrosse is like one of the, it's like the second most dangerous game in the world next to, I want to say, high lie, which is certainly the most dangerous game in the world. Bill can fact check me on all this.
Oh, I'm pretty sure the most dangerous game in the world is man, but...
What's man? What do you mean?
Nothing. Keep going.
Man, bear, pig?
No, isn't that a book? A movie, The Most Dangerous Game? It was a movie that came out where a guy was hunting, he flew some people to his island to hunt them. It's called The Most Dangerous Game.
Bill, you're really dating. Man. You're dating us. You're
Listen,
really,
I'm old, dude. I'm old.
You're really dating because I remember that movie and I remember being 15 thinking this is so intense. This is so cool. Oh, embarrassing. Hey, speaking of dating us, and sorry, Cameron, I don't mean to step right away from you after we just said hello to you, but how about that new Tool track, Bill? What do you think?
Listen, you agreed to give me 3 minutes to rant on Tool and I'm so excited. So thank you so much for the opportunity.
Do you mean rant or rave?
Listen, whatever you want to call it, man. It's been 13 years since they released their last album. 10,000 Days came out about 5,000 days ago, but it came out in 2006. To put that in perspective, Casey and I were grad students at Boston Conservatory together at that time. George W. Bush was in the middle of his second term. It has been 13 years since they've released an album, and I couldn't be more excited. And one thing that's cool, if you ever... If you like, of course, Danny Carey is an amazing drummer. I think that's why everybody should like Tool. They're one of the most influential rock bands of all time. If you want to buy the CD, they've always been at the forefront of really interesting getting with the CD. So I'll read from their press release here what you get if you actually buy the CD. So the collectible offering, which was conceived by and directed by Adam Jones, who's the guitarist, features a 4-inch HD rechargeable screen with exclusive video footage, charging cable, 2-watt speaker, a 36-page booklet, and a digital download card.
What?
So they're actually, in the CD packaging, going to have a little HD screen and have a little speaker and have music videos and stuff going on, which just blows my mind.
That's unprecedented.
It's awesome. The other big thing with Tool is their catalog has never been available streaming until this month. So they were one of the last major label rock bands to not have their stuff online. If you are interested and you've never heard Tool before, go to Apple Music, go to Spotify. If you've never heard them, you kind of want an entry-level gateway drug, in case you can back me up on this one, or you might have some different thoughts. I would recommend listening to Anima first. I think it's a good hybrid of straight-ahead rock, and then the second half of the album is kind of going a little more prog rock where they are now. But it's an incredible album. Lateralis is great. That's my favorite album. I think that's the best drumming that Danny Carey does. I'm just super excited.
Bill, that's the most poetically I've ever heard you speak, and most eloquent, most most academic rant you've ever had, and it was about Tool.
Could it, yeah, can that be part of my, like, could that have been part of, like, my doctoral, like, qualifiers, right? I mean, I could have nailed the dates on those albums. Michaud, who cares? But Tool, that's what, yeah.
Ben, I think you were going to say something.
Yeah, I had a related question for Cameron about the Tool stuff. So, Cameron, I know that you were recently, like I said, you recently announced this performance with the Dallas Winds under Jerry Junkin of Hayden Percussion Concerto, which is quite a big deal. Could you tell us about that?
Sure, yeah. During my time at Eastman, sort of the last concert cycle, Jerry Junkin came in to guest conduct the wind ensemble, and there was this piece called the Migration Symphony by Adam Schoenberg, and there were two marching snare parts. So I was playing one of these marching snare parts, and I was up at the front of the stage, so I got to interact with Jerry a lot. I would, like, walk out into the crowd and play this part, and this is one of those things. I was talking on another podcast about opportunities that professors or teachers give you at, like, just the right time. And the wind conductor at Eastman actually talked to Jerry about me sort of behind the scenes and hooked up a performance there, of the Hayden Concerto. And he didn't tell me about it. And Jerry approached me at the end of the concert and he was like, hey, I'm going to be in touch with you tomorrow. And, like, do you have a card for me? And I was like, you know, I scrambled and I got him a card and he sent me a text in the morning. I remember waking up to a text with the Dallas Winds gig being offered, which was really crazy. So yeah, I know he has, like, a lot of relationships with young percussionists from UT, and I just feel really fortunate to be able to do that. I'm excited.
Yeah, I know several years ago he did the Doherty Concerto with Tom Barrett and the Dallas Winds. Could you tell us a bit about your experience with the Hayden Percussion Concerto, which is one of my all-time favorite works?
Yeah. That's a piece that I've played, I think, maybe just two times now, but I have two performances coming up next season. First was at Capital University during my undergrad, and the second was with the Eastman Wind Ensemble. That was the first time I played it. I had no business playing it, and we did, like, this big video recording of it and everything, and thankfully I took that one down. It was a little embarrassing, but it's a piece that, like, every time you play it, there's something new for you to find, and there's this mean Crotale, like, in the middle of it, that I totally botched on the first gig. I think it's one of the best percussion concertos because of her use of color and, you know, sounding like a nerd here, but her orchestration's great. The middle section sits for quite a while. Some people tend to not like that about the piece, but I think it's actually really great as long as the ensemble plays it well enough. I think there's a lot of times people take it too slow. I think that's sort of a problem, but that's just, you know, being opinionated, I guess, about it. But I love the piece. I heard a rumor that she's writing another one, but I don't know if that's true. For what it's worth, I'm spreading rumors here on the At Percussion podcast.
I think I remember she might have even mentioned something about that. Maybe for Colin Curry. I don't know. But yeah, I also like there's one section of the percussion concerto that has this great interaction between the soloist and the percussion section, which is always, I think, an audience favorite moment.
Yeah, I love it too because she doesn't write anything about a cadenza. There's just a fermata over a bar of rest, and that's it. That's all you get. So you can just improvise, and that call and response section comes out of the cadenza. So that's always something, like Mark Ford's performance or Colin's performance. Everybody has their own thing they do with it, and I think that's kind of cool to have, you know, your thing. I do crossovers, you know, do some quad things in it from the drum corps days. Shout out to the Blue Devils for last night. Shameless plug there, but really excited for them. But anyways, I love the piece. The Hayden's great.
One of my favorite things about drum corps finals is hearing all the people on social media that you don't think of affiliated with drum corps, and you learn their way into it. Like, one of my music theory professors is attending the finals, or attended the finals, and I thought, like, oh, yeah, he said, I'm so excited. It's my first time. I've heard so much about this, and I really don't know much about it. And, of course, he's going to love it. I mean, he's going to have such a good time, you know? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you marched Blue Devils, right, Cameron?
Yeah, I marched the quad line at Blue Devils and Rhythm X for indoor.
Hey, can I, just changing topics here a little bit, you mentioned that you're going to start your own podcast pretty soon.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us a little about, because, I mean, of course, that's like a whole journey I started and continuing with this podcast. And I'm just wondering, man, like, yeah, what's what made you want to do that? And how are you going to do it? How is it going to be different? And what do I have to do to keep up and compete?
Yeah, I never thought I would be into podcasts at all. I was always the kind of person that, like, when I would sit down at a coffee shop and work, I was always listening to music. And somewhere along the lines, I started, I got big into, like, Gary Vaynerchuk, if you guys know who that is. Gary V. He's like a business guy, and he does all the, he puts out all this content. I got into him for a few months at Eastman, and eventually he just wears you down, like, with just the same stuff. So it's like, okay, I think I got what I needed from that, like, motivational type stuff, you know, and documenting. And then I at some point started listening to Joe Rogan. My friend was twisting my arm. He's like, listen to the Joe Rogan podcast, you know. And I love that Joe has all different kinds of people on. And so I've been listening to his podcast for a really long time, and there's stuff that I learn and stuff that I disagree with on there. There's all sorts of great stuff, but he has a lot of scientists and psychologists and things like that. And so after watching that, I was like, you know what? I've been having a lot of interesting conversations with people, just random people, whether or not they're percussionists, it doesn't really matter. And I was like, I kind of want to document this. So I just moved into a new house, finally have like my own studio and everything. And there's a spare bedroom, which I just sort of converted to this podcast studio. So I've been pumping in some money right now over the last 2 weeks, and Amazon's been delivering packages every day with these mics and tables and stuff. But I wanted to do it like the way that I envision it is unedited, not live streamed, but just very little post-production, put it up, one camera angle. And then also doing Skype podcasts too for people that can't come by. Because, I mean, who comes to Columbus, Ohio, really? But
yeah, sure. I think something that Joe Rogan does that's really impressive is, yeah, he'll have, like you said, such a variety of guests and personalities on. Mm-hmm. And like you mentioned, yes, yeah, so many of them I disagree with. And so, but yet you still are willing to come back and listen again. And he somehow does it in a way that you don't mind that you're, I don't know, like you almost feel like, oh, he's promoting this really bad idea or this bad ideology of a certain person. Mm-hmm. But somehow, I don't know, he challenges them enough or just the right amount that you are willing to go back and listen again. Or at least that's been my feeling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot of weird associations that can come with listening to him. So I'm always careful about it. You know, you got to put disclaimers on everything, I think, these days. But that's one, too, where it's like, I agree with a lot. I don't disagree with a lot, but I learned so much listening to him that I think it's worth it. And he's a great, I mean, with his MMA stuff, he's just a great talker, you know, he does
right.
a great job at right. facilitating conversation. And so.
Cool.
Yeah.
Cameron, do you anticipate it being more like a free flowing conversation, or are you imagining like a segmented thing or kind of a hybrid of both?
I like the idea of just a conversation, you know, sure. The best nuggets come from conversation. And of course, I think I'll probably have like some background questions to ask or backup questions rather. But by and large, I think I just want to like hit go, start talking. And then at some point I'm going to just, that's where I'm going to start when I put the episode up. You know what I mean?
Sure.
I don't know. I like that better. And nothing against, I mean, obviously with us here, it's different. There's so many people, but I just envision one-on-one conversations and.
So you're going to be like the Colin Cowherd or the Joe Rogan of the podcasting world.
I don't know about that, but yeah, I'm like, I think I'm just going to have on some like friends from high school, you know?
Sure.
But there's like people in town that I know, like police officers and stuff. I'm like, man, they have some crazy stories, or someone like that's been an EMT for like a really long time and she's seen some stuff, you know, and I want to like learn from that. And I think that everybody sure. should be able to hear these people's stories and, for whatever audience I can garner, you know, the 10 people that listen or whatever it's going to be. So, yeah.
I've had people ask
That's
enough,
great.
ask enough times like, oh, how do you even start a podcast? Like, what do you do? And I know that could probably take a whole hour to explain, but could you tell us, and I don't know, with, you know, your best approximation of starting it, like, okay, like how do you do that? How do you record and publish and get it on iTunes and Spotify? Da, 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 da.
Yeah. Well, the next step for me is to figure out that iTunes Spotify thing. I'm not there yet. I haven't recorded my first episode. This wall behind me, just off to the side here, is going to be the background. And I have some shelving I'm going to hang with, like, you know, some like Sabian symbols and Black Swan stuff. But I also have like some cool things, like a cookie jar that's a cow that moves, like really goofy stuff that I'm going to put up there. Yeah. So I got to decorate the wall first. But to actually start it, I mean, for me, I really wanted high quality mics, and I put a post on Facebook like, what mics can I use for this, but also for marimba? I want a double dip. And so I got these are like the AT 2035s. And so there's like a package. You get the mic and the boom arm and everything. It's like $200. So I got two of those and some office chairs, cheap from IKEA. First time to IKEA. It was like a wonderland, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God.
I went 2 days in a row. Like after the first day, I was like, this is not enough.
Did you manage to only buy the chairs or did you buy a whole bedroom worth of other stuff?
No, I bought other stuff. So
of course you did.
Yeah, this is like the reason I went with all black. I found an all black globe and I was like, that is so cool. So I bought it and then I found these little golden balls. Look at this. I found these golden balls. I was like, man. So it's like little planets next to the globe. And so I'm going to buy a golden Sharpie and everybody that comes into the podcast is going to sign the globe.
Oh, cool.
So I was like, all right. Nice. So now I'm like, I need a black table. The mics are black. So everything's going to be black shelving. So when I bring out this, this cookie jar here, this is going to be in stark contrast. To what's going on with all the black. So, yeah.
I don't know. Ben, I don't know how we're going to compete with this.
I don't know. It's going to be the end of us.
So, all right. So you need to go to IKEA. I'll get more funny stuff in the background. I think I need that sound effects machine back.
I do have, I was telling the guys before we started here, I'll show this again. I walked into my office today, which is always a mess. I have it blurred, but I walked into my office to this. Sitting on my chair.
So I guess your students dropped that off for you.
I have no idea. I thought about just wearing it, not acknowledging it.
That would be great. What was going on? We were talking about podcasts. And then like camcorder lighting. I don't know if I've never thought about lighting before, but I realized that like this old house that I live in now, everything's real yellow. So I went and I got like this really cheap lighting kit on it. Man, I'm an Amazon junkie now. So I've just been ordering all this stuff, but it was probably like a $1,200 investment or $1,500. And so sort of the thought behind it is talking to interesting people, but also possible collaborators in the future, instead of sending them your press kit with a really cold email and them not caring about it, just inviting them to be on the podcast and just talking to them. And if they say yes, maybe at the end of that hour or 2 hours, they would want to work with you. You know, I think that's an interesting strategy, but also, sure. You know, again, double dipping as much as you can.
Well, I know I had the urge with my travels and performances. There's so many of them. You go out, you meet someone really, really interesting, and then you don't know when you're ever going to talk to them again. And you had such a great, 2 days with them or whatever. And it is a way to like keep having the same people in your life again and again and again. Like here, Bill is on the show for the third or fourth time. Caleb's on the show for probably the 10th time. And, Ben is one of those people. He had me out as a guest artist years ago. It's like, man, it'd be great to like stay in touch with this person. And I mean, now we know each other like really, really well. And it's, because of this podcast. Yeah. Sorry, Ben, I steamrolled you again, but it was related.
Well, yeah, on a related note, Cameron, I know, is one of maybe the best percussionists I've ever seen at like the whole like social media self-promotion side of things. Very good promoter without being annoying, which I think we've all encountered. And there's even a quote on your website from Jalissa at Yamaha about Cameron's like digital press kit. Could you tell us about how you got so good at that stuff and how the places you've gotten with it?
Yeah. Well, thank you. I appreciate that. That's something that I feel like I'm still experimenting and finding that right balance. I think maybe all of us are. And there was a really annoying phase that I was annoying myself with what I was posting and how much I was posting. And it's all like sort of trial and error. And so I ask my really close friends to evaluate me, unabridged. Just tell me what you really see and what you think about this stuff. And so I feel like right now I'm at a place where I'm posting a lot less and I really like it. Bless you, Casey.
I feel terrible. Thank you. It's like the worst.
Backtrack here what I was saying. So anyways, right now I find myself posting a lot less. But at some point when I started doing this thing, I was just asking a lot of questions. And you can learn a lot from rock bands and from people that are not in the classical music world with making a press kit or a one sheet and figuring out what that is. I think most of the time we go through school and when someone said the two words press kit to me, I didn't even know what they were saying. It's like when you don't know what you don't know. So I had no idea that that existed. So I started asking around, and once I, once that Yamaha competition happened, right, and I went out there to Indianapolis, and we did that whole weekend thing where you perform and all that stuff. I met Jalissa and John Whitman, which are amazing people, and they kind of helped me through more of it. At the end of the day, it's like you're just trying to communicate an idea respectfully, but also you're asking for something from people, and you have to find that balance in the language you use, and you have to anticipate how people are viewing it. If they're seeing what they're seeing on the front page, are they going to be drawn in? How you break the text up? You know, there are all these little details, and it's sort of like a game of human psychology, I guess, with how you promote yourself. And I hate to put it in those terms, but that's sort of what it is. And eventually you stop thinking about it in such technical terms and you just kind of do it, I think. And it's better when it gets to that point, because microanalyzing, it's no fun, but you sort of have to build that routine or that skill set, I guess. Sorry, I'm kind of veering off here, but if you want to course correct, please feel free.
I had a question regarding like your website and your press, because mm-hmm. I'm taking a look at it right now, and you know, obviously it looks very slick. And one of the things I really appreciate about how it looks is everything is super consistent. You obviously had, you either designed the logo or you had a graphic artist design a logo, and that's consistent. You're using the same kind of fonts throughout both the press kit and your website. How much of that was your decision? How much of that did you outsource? Did you have any friends kind of help you with that process?
Yeah. The first iteration of all of that, which is sort of where it is now still, we're working on sort of a version two of everything. I posted out again on Facebook. I just usually say like, hey, someone help me. I need a logo. That was what I said. I think it was March of 2017. And so I had like 40 people comment and say like, oh, this person. And nobody commented and said me, you know, like, hey, ask me. And I didn't want to go through these 40 people. It was like a lot of work. So I just kind of let it sit for a few days. And I got a DM from somebody that I went to high school with. And she was like, hey, I actually do this for a living. I'm a branding designer. Just let me do this. Trust me. I was like, okay, I trust you. Fine. Less work. And so that was really great. And she did all of that work there that you see. I constructed the website, but I knew like, okay, this page, I want a full bleed photo. So send me like 3 full bleed photos, 2 banners. And then I'll construct the website. The way that Squarespace works, it's not very like designer friendly. You just have to have like blocks and things like that. So that was how that got started. And I've been messing with all of that same stuff for the last 2 years. I downloaded the Adobe suite and I use Illustrator to edit that press kit myself now, because you know, why pay somebody $50 an hour or whatever to change the type, you know, as opposed to, like, right. If it's design work, that's different. So that's what I did there. And since then, we've sort of like parted ways with what we were doing. And I'm starting to work with Sarah James now. I'm sure you guys know Sarah. She's great. And so I'm really excited to redesign everything, or to some extent redesign it and go a different route, which is exciting for me. But I think what I have now works, but I have a totally different vision for what comes next. And yeah, so I want to use Wix. Squarespace is being such a hassle.
I host 2 websites on Wix, so I can definitely vouch for the fact that it's pretty easy to use that one. Yeah. I've heard some horror stories with Squarespace. So, but yeah, it's still a good hosting site.
Yeah, and like my issue with it, my biggest one is that you can't edit the mobile only version on Squarespace separately. So, the way that it optimizes for mobile and it moves things around, it's usually not good, and you have to make sacrifices on both ends, on both ways you view your site. And on Wix, you can just edit the mobile view, and that's way more effective. I mean, because now over 50% of traffic is on mobile, so we need to think about that more than that actual website view. So mine doesn't look so great on phones.
I noticed, like, I accessed your website on my iPhone, and it, the text was it shrunk the thing down, and so it was not as user friendly as it could be. But it still looks great. So good job on the design. Thanks. I mean, and I know you want to go forward with a different one, but it looks great.
Yeah, thanks.
Man, the I think Sarah James made everyone's stuff.
Yeah.
She just has a monopoly and everyone kind of is just figured it out. No, she does like excellent work. She does, I think, all of Drew Tucker's as well.
Hey, I made mine forever ago and I still really like it. I made it when I was like mine's pretty cool, right? Little treble clef in the where the G is. That's pretty good.
It's kind of, but
for like an old man.
like when I work with people that do it for a living, like Sarah James or my friend Emily Nadeau, when they make stuff for me, like I always think I can go back and like make a good product. But then when I see what they send me on their first draft, like it's just so much better. Like I feel like it's really, if you're going to make a press packet or a website and you really want to do it, like even if it's, you know, a couple hundred bucks, just it's a small investment for the quality you get.
Yeah. And that's a good,
it really does make a difference. Yeah.
That's a good point too. Just like the fact that you have to pay for these things. A lot of people, like sometimes you want people to do the work for free, but and you can find somebody that's in school and willing to do it, but there really is a difference if you find someone who's legit and you can pay to do that work. But it is an investment. People always ask me about that, so I thought I'd throw that out there.
Hey, does anybody want to know what happened in music history today?
What happened in music history today?
Thanks, Bill. I appreciate it. So we're releasing on July 29th, and on July 29th, Stockhausen, he delivered a lecture titled Music and Graphics. So yeah, graphics in his music, and he delivered part four at the famous Darmstadt. And there's lots of details about this. If the best source I found for what is in this lecture is in a little book titled New Music at Darmstadt Nano, Stockhausen, Cage, and Berlez by Martin Idon. And there's some great details in chapter five. Chapter five is titled In Cage's Wake, as in John Cage. And yeah, I read a good deal of this, and unfortunately, it's not just about what was in the lecture itself, but about criticisms to the lecture, responses to the lecture, influences, etc. And you can watch online a different lecture of Stockhausen's. This was in 1959, so I could not find any recording of this. There's a transcript of the original lecture, but it sounds like he's kind of kept it and gradually modified it. And the way the book describes the lecture, what happened in it, it's very similar to a lecture you can find online, a newer one of his, which is titled Intuitive Music. It's in four parts. You can watch it for free on YouTube. And it does share a lot of the same things. And it's basically how he uses graphics, what a lot of them mean. And a lot of it is very, very basic. And maybe that's just because it's a little dated now or something, or we're a little more familiar with it, but simply saying, okay, if I have a line here, it can mean this. If I have a triangle this way, it can mean that, so on and so forth. So yeah, that's something that happened today, August 29th, 1959.
Cool, Casey. Thanks for sharing.
Yeah, to get sure.
To sort of more musical and less music business topics, Cameron, you've performed extensively one of my favorite pieces that I've just started performing, which is, I'll probably butcher the French title, but Si Si Ne Passe Un Ball, something like that, translates to, "This is, it is not a ball." But I saw it first a few years ago at PASIC by the Trio SR9 guys. And the second I saw it, there's a trio version and a solo version. The second I saw it, I knew I had to have it. And I ordered the score from some European website, waited literally like 3 months to get the score in, and was just so excited. So, Cameron, could you tell us about that piece?
Yeah, that piece, yeah, it's like my favorite piece to play right now. And play is like a very loose word, I guess. But I saw it first when we were on the World Percussion Group Tour in 2017. Who played that? Shin. Her name was Shin. She's like a soloist from France. She was studying in Lyon, but she did that piece and I was like, oh my God, I'd never seen anything like it. And everybody in Europe knew it. Like, oh, the bouncy ball piece, you know, and everybody was, I had never seen anything like that. And then, like you said, at PASIC, SR9 did it. And I just like randomly wound up at like some the bowling bar in Indianapolis. I don't know if you guys know what I'm talking about, where all the games and stuff, it's a giant place. I like wound up at the same table as them. I was like, oh, your trio SR9, that's pretty cool. But that piece was one where I started to like look at the score and I was like, absolutely not. And I just pulled up the video of him playing or performing it at Tromp. And I just learned it that way. Cause the score, I remember like writing individual things on all of the note heads, like, okay, slap chest, do this. And I was like, this is not happening. So I just learned it on the video. And I think like, weirdly enough, like my drum corps and WGI background, because now it's like all performance art stuff, you know, we make fun of it as much as, you know, I make fun of it as much as the next guy. But I think that really helped with learning that piece. And the audiences tend to love it. and the little kids. Like, I like ending recitals with it. So if I freak them out with some of the other stuff, it's a good way to like, okay, you know, let's all get out of here and ha ha ha. And there have been a couple awkward shows where like people don't know if they should laugh because it's you know, they don't feel proper or whatever. So before the piece starts, I always try to, I don't like to talk before it. I like to go straight into it from the applause of the last piece and have sort of a transition.
My students learned it, and then I had to learn the third part. But the funny thing for me was we performed After Stuba by Mark Ford the next night. And there was one little moment where we actually, someone had the ball in their pocket in the middle of After Stuba. They tossed the ball over my head. The audience that was there for two nights in a row kind of got a kick out of that.
Okay.
And I'm doing the same thing next month. I'm doing a recital at UNT, and we're going to reprise the random ball toss in the middle of After Stuba. Should be a hit.
That's cool.
You had a story, Cameron, about like forgetting your ball.
Oh, yeah. I probably posted about that. I was thinking like, how does he know that? That was at Eastman. Like that was my master's recital. It was like the last piece on the show. And at that point.
But before Cameron tells the story, you should probably mention that this whole piece, you're manipulating an imaginary ball and you have a foam ball in your pocket that at the end of the piece you pull out and all of a sudden you have the actual ball.
Yeah. I didn't realize they're like, what are they talking about? And I love it too, because it's like, it's just theatrical. It's fun. And the ball takes on all these different characters. You crack an egg, you have a little Shakespeare in there. So I was going on for the last piece of my recital, which was going to be trilogy, like the full three movements of trilogy. But then that was going to segue directly into the bouncy ball piece. And I remember, like, I looked at Kat Cole, who was another student at Eastman with me, and she was supposed to run back to my apartment for me and grab the bouncy ball. I was like, can you go grab the bouncy ball, you know, I think at intermission or whatever. And she's like, oh, my God, I didn't go get the bouncy ball, you know. And so I was like, oh, you know, what am I going to do? So I just, like, opened up my bag, and I saw my Becker Blue, and I just popped the top off of it and put it in my pocket. So, you know, it wasn't a very good-looking ball. Usually I have, like, a larger orange one, but it definitely got the job done. But my Becker Blue, I still have not re-glued it, and it's been 2 years. So, yeah.
Not playing a whole ragtime these days, huh?
No rags.
So, Cameron, we kind of talked a little bit about this earlier with the Higdon Concerto, but Jade Hales left a Facebook question. How have you made contact with organizations with the intent of being a featured performer? Seeing as you are rather new to the scene, how have you convinced orchestras and performing ensembles to take you seriously? Love your playing and can't wait for the Sejourné Commission.
Yeah, I think the funny answer to that is that I haven't convinced anybody, really. You get 10 times more no's than you do yeses. So that's the first thing that people should know, is that for every 10 emails, you might get one back, and that's probably a no. So then you come to that thing where you have to use your contacts, and you have to use, you know, the friend of a friend kind of thing to get your foot in the door. And the only thing you're trying to do as a young player is to build people's trust. When you're going around to different places, all that matters is that whether or not they took you seriously before you got there, like, okay, yeah, we can throw you $100, maybe, you know, come do something at our school. All that matters is when you leave that they've bought into what you do. And not just as like, not just as a player, but as a person. I mean, the whole thing, the whole package. So for me, that's been very important, is going around and just trying to be very honest and vulnerable and open about what it is I'm trying to do. And it seems very off-putting to a lot of people when you self-promote. And I think it's a slippery slope for sure, but you just have to manage that. So to that question's point, you have to just use your own connections. And when you're cold calling an orchestra, that's where the materials come in handy, like the one sheet or the press kit. It needs to look so good. And the email needs to be very concise. And you don't want to waste their time with what you're saying there. Just get to that attachment, you know, and check it out. And if that hits you and it wows you, maybe they'll scroll past or scroll to the next page or whatever. But that's a tough one. Getting into the orchestra game without management is almost impossible. And all of the concertos that I'm playing next season, I think all of them were mutual connections. I don't think any of them were cold calls. And so the next step is to look into getting a manager for the 2021 season.
Yeah, I think one thing that kind of goes without saying is just like being easy to work with and and knowing people. Like that's, I mean, Casey started as like a friend of friends, and I just kind of got in touch with them and sent him out to FAU, and it went well, and I ended up having him here also. And before we even started recording, I knew Cameron was going to be in Dallas, so we were like talking. It's like, hey, you want to come by Tarleton? So yeah, I think just being easy to work with, being available.
Yeah, and this season, for me, like just going around to different places, whenever there's something where you're sharing, like sharing a concert or you're on faculty with like a bunch of people, what sticks out the most is the person who is hard to work with. And it, you know, and it sticks out to everybody, and then everybody finds themselves in some corner at some point saying like, did you hear what that person said? And like, we can pretend like we don't gossip, but we all gossip, right? And what's funny is like when you see that happen, you're like, wow, I really hope I'm not being that person in any situation. And especially as a young person going around trying to do it, you don't want to be that person. So if I show up somewhere and like none of the gear is there and they don't know how the electronics work or whatever, it's like, it's totally fine, you know? And by and large, I don't get to even touch an instrument before I play a concert because I'm just dealing with like bad logistics or, you know, and I usually set aside like 6 hours before a gig, but with all the electronics and things, there's usually no warm up and no one helping to schlep gear, you know, save for a few instances where they've gotten the studio to like rally and help you. But, and that's, it comes with the territory, you know, it just is part of the gig. Until you get down the road and you can have the 3-page writer request and only green M&Ms, you know.
This reminds me, like, just knowing the situation you're walking to. I mentioned this music festival I was at in California, and I knew it was going to be disorganized. I was there last year. I knew we were going to have problems with the gear. And so I had to organize, I think there was 3 chamber concerts, and the first one was, like, Tuesday of the first week, like, super soon. And I just knew, without them even telling me, I knew the instruments were going to get screwed up. Have instruments. We did an entirely instrumentless concert. So we did the ball piece, we did John Cage living room music, and we did table music, I think. And it was like the perfect solution to walking into a situation just going, I know I'm not going to have instruments, but I can make this work.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wanted to add to that real quick. What you said about your ethic and how you approach things, I think, is spot on. I was listening to Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, and they had Henry Winkler, who was better known as the Fonz, on as the guest for the game show portion. And he said, I think, a quote that kind of sums up what you were saying. The way he found happiness in life is through tenacity and gratitude. And he never forgot that. And that's how he's able to keep the career going that he has and be happy doing what he's doing. That was it. I like that quote.
That's great.
Yeah, that's excellent. That's
good. I had a Facebook question that, along with another question, and it's not the will you be my soulmate one, but...
Yes, Jonathan, I will.
Oh,
sorry.
Well, that's good for him, I guess. but yeah, it's actually Alex Johnston or Johnstone's question. Have you organized your day to be successful in performing and teaching? And then I mentioned to a few people I was doing this today and you're going to be on. And this question's come up in regards to you and to a bunch of, I'll just say, up and coming people. And like, I feel like no one wants to ask it in a public forum, so I'll just ask for the anonymity of everyone that I've heard this from. Is I often hear like, how do you afford to travel and to do all these things and to like manage this professional traveling and playing while also holding down a teaching studio, getting that practice in, you know, making that work with a, you know, a life?
Yeah. Okay. So the first thing, just put it on the table. My debt is in the 6 figures. So that's a really important one. And you know, we can all try to act like there's, you know, we don't have that or that we don't want to talk about it or whatever. And I just think like that's such a stupid taboo. Yeah. So and I've seen on like the late night talk shows too, famous actors and actresses saying like, oh, you know, I still haven't paid off my college loans. You're like, what? You have millions of dollars, or at least we think they do. And maybe they don't actually, but be that as it may. So there's a lot of debt involved. And when you purchase an instrument like a marimba, you're probably just going to be taking out a loan for that as well. Now, most of the money that I make just goes straight back into buying instruments. So like I have Cristales on the way right now, and I just try to get the things that I really need. And in my mind, it's like some instruments are for practice. Like I have a kick drum that's falling apart with one head on it, and I just need it for practice because I know I'm not going to take it to a gig. But then if I want to put on my own show here in Ohio, I want to make sure I have all my own instruments. If I ever did want to rent a truck and just haul out of my house to a church, charge $10 for a ticket and put on a show. So with the instruments, I would say like for me, most of my money goes back into that. Now, in terms of like the travel and stuff, every arrangement's different with universities or whatever venue you're playing at. By and large, if it's like a performing arts series or a concerto, something like a tier above the university level, I guess. Not that they're even on the same level. They're basically just separate entities. But something like that, they're always going to pay your travel. And if they're not, make them pay your travel, because that's just how that works. Then you start getting into contract things and riders and all that kind of stuff. But they're always going to pay your travel and pay your lodging if they're a legit organization. And then they're going to pay you some sort of fee. And that fee is probably, I mean, of course, it's going to be a three-figure fee. Always. But usually it's between like 500 and 1,000 or something like that. And then as you start to get more experienced, you're going to be making 2, 3, you know, this kind of thing. And concertos, there are people making a ton of money on concertos. Like there are some legit soloists out there pulling 5-figure fees every weekend playing a concerto. And that's just the name of the game.
I know one artist, I won't say who, but I know this person's fee is $30,000 for one night.
Yeah. I mean, like a lot of like high class violinists, you can think of whoever that brings to mind, you know, $40,000, 30, 20. And at the top of the percussion heap, fees are being tossed around the 10 range, you know? So I think people need to know those numbers. And that's important to talk about. University gigs are obviously much less. There are much lower fees unless there's a performing arts series there or whatever. But eventually what you find out is that, okay, I'm going to travel to this city and someone's paying my flight. So let me just call up the universities in the area or someone else in the area and tack on a few extra things. I can charge less because I'm already going to be in town. And it's essentially extra money for playing more shows. And then you just have to be smart about not programming different rep at every stop, because then you can't handle it. You're going to have a bad show. If someone's there, you're going to get a bad review, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, but that's a question. Yeah, nobody wants to ask. It's like, you know, I'm making like an entry-level salary, essentially, for like any gig, any job that you would take. And it's just where you put that money is important, and how you, like I played a lot of free gigs last year, but on paper it looks really good because you played those gigs.
Well, yeah. It sounds like you're very realistic about it. You're mm-hmm. very aware. You're not pretending like you don't have the debt like some people do.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. And like you said, you're being open about it. That seems really, I don't know. That's cool. You know, that's very, very cool.
Yeah. I like, I mean, I'm glad you said like, you don't think it should be a taboo thing. I mean, mm-hmm. kind of in the composition vein, I've had people message me and say like, hey, how much are we supposed to charge for a commission? I'm just like, dude, I don't know. Like, how? You tell me how much we're supposed to charge.
Was that me who emailed you that?
No, it wasn't you.
Because I have no idea. Yeah. But I was going to say real quick also, it's great, Cameron, that you're not sitting still, you know, because so many people ask, like, how do you get this happening? How do you get this going? And either, like, if it's not just coming to you, then, which for, yeah, so many, most people, it is not. And certainly nobody starts that way. Yeah, you can't just sit still and say like, well, I did everything I'm supposed to. I have all my playing abilities really good. And I went through all my programs. I have my degrees. Where's my stage, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, you're being very proactive about it. That's smart.
Yeah, and thinking about that too, something I talked about when I was in Houston a few weeks ago, and we did this like little miniature interview. And it came. This sort of thing came up, and it's like there are no apprenticeships or internships to being a soloist. There are for maybe like opera singers. There are different festivals you can go to, but no one, you know, you're not getting like 10 solo recitals booked for you to play for free as a learning experience to understand what that's like. The only training you can get is to actually go out and do it, and then you can't expect any money on those first shows. So. You just have to call somebody, and it has to be someone you know, and you just play a recital there and get a video of it, get a quote from that person if it didn't suck, you know, and it probably will suck the first time. There are so many things that you don't think about you have to do, once you go out and you tour, logistically that you do, that all gets in the way of the music going on stage. I mean, and it just, it always will until you get used to that feeling. And so, yeah, that's something that I've thought about a lot. It's like, we don't have any like apprenticeship programs or internships. You can't, there's no on, it's just on the job training. So
I had a quick question that kind of tied to this. So you were teaching at Kent State University, and so you were the director of the percussion program there. Is that correct?
No, I was an adjunct assisting Matt Holm and doing the drum line.
Okay. So it's, and you're no longer teaching there, right?
Correct.
You're not, okay. So it's interesting. I like how things, you basically kind of bet on yourself, because even adjunct teaching jobs are hard to come by these days. There's a lot of DMA people out there looking for even the adjunct jobs. They're just not very common. And you had one, and you were like, you know what? It's in my best interest to maybe not be tied down to that position, I'm assuming, and to give myself the flexibility. And I'm going to invest all of these resources into myself, because I'm betting on myself. And I think that's a huge thing to model, I think, to potential people that are getting into this career. It's like, listen, at some point, you're going to have to bet on yourself. You're going to have to step outside of the comfort zone, you know, if you truly believe in what you're doing. So,
yeah, I mean, that was a humongous crossroads for me. And I'm so glad that it happened my first semester out of school. I mean, I couldn't be more happy about that. And, you know, blessed, privileged, whatever you want to say. It was an awesome thing to have to deal with that and have to deal with that decision. We all make these hard decisions and we learn so much from them, but it was like, it was pretty good money. I mean, it wasn't the best, but I was also driving 2.5-3 hours one way to do it, 2 or 3 times a week, depending. I set my schedule at the very beginning of the semester, so everybody knew when I was and was not going to be there, but it wasn't benefiting the students at all. I mean, I gave them the amount of lessons they needed and some sort of odd configuration of a schedule, and the drum line suffered there because of it. And I just started to realize, like, you know, what is teaching? Teaching is essentially just serving your students. And if you can't do that and you don't have the time to do that, even if you have the time, you don't have the mental bandwidth, then you shouldn't be there. And someone who wants that job and has earned that job should have that. It made a lot of sense. Like, I'm going to step back, and if this is a stupid move, then I've earned that stupid move. But this is where everything's heading, so why not just, you know, roll the dice and go for it? But I think I always knew in the back of my head, like, this thing's going to work out because it has to. And that's the only, I think it's the only way you can really do something like this. So I don't know. It's just a risk. And I'm loving it, but anytime I'm like sitting around watching like Mike Tyson's Mysteries or some dumb show, you know, and like losing brain cells, it's like, oh my God, I should probably be downstairs practicing.
Yeah.
Of because of like the money that I left on the table or the, you know, the solid job or whatever you want to call it.
Well, I know, yeah, being in a position where you have to consider hiring different adjuncts and yeah, I mean, convenience, you know, you're, would you say 2 to 3 hour drive? That to me, it just like, oh yeah, well, of course that would do it. You know, that would do it for me too. You know, it's usually not the time commitment in the job. It's the time commitment, like getting to, and yeah, I know when we've looked for adjuncts at the two schools I've worked at, it's always been a like, well, who is in the area, who's close by that will be really good, and we can pay what we can afford and have it be worth it for them. So yeah, it seems like it just has to be like, they're good jobs, but yeah, everything just kind of has to be right. You know, they have to be in the town or the timing has to be good. Like, so Caleb, for instance, he's finishing his dissertation. He's close by, girlfriend lives here in town. It's like, it makes perfect sense to hire Caleb, have him teach at JMU, which he's going to do next year. So yeah, timing's really good.
Yeah.
Congrats, Caleb. I didn't know that.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I don't always put my life events on Facebook. I mainly use it to get shit on by Jim Whitfield. Can I say that?
I think you can. Yeah, I think so. Yeah. I don't care.
It's been some funny stuff if anybody wants to check it out. It's good stuff.
That's good. Yep. Just you got tooled on a little bit, I guess.
Oh, it's good. That's quality humor going on over there. So
it happens. It happens. Well, speaking of quality humor, I think we have one more Facebook question, and it's from our buddy Brandon Arve. And it's for Cameron, but I'm going to tag team this one with him.
Yeah.
And it's something about why is a cat better than a dog? Why a cat and not a dog, Cameron?
Well, I'm looking at my cat right now. She's sitting next to the window. I mean, she's just so cute. And she just moved a little. She's asleep in the sunlight, you know.
What'd
you say?
Can you please show us your cat?
I have too many cords connected to my computer, or I would. Her name's Lucy, but she's evil. I mean, she's super evil. But I love her to death. Low maintenance, super chill, you know. Might sleep on you at night, might not. Just give some treats every once in a while. She doesn't care. We leave, we come back, you know. I don't know. It's easy to be on the road and someone checks in on her. Yeah, I don't know.
A dog is a step below a kid. I mean, a kid is just a little bit more work than a dog. And I honestly mean that.
Yeah. No dogs for me.
I like dogs. And that's the weird thing about cat people. They also like dogs, but dog people will just like hate cats. Yeah. I would be happy to have a dog.
But Cameron, to your point too, you're on the road an awful lot. So having a dog would be like just a nightmare to travel with.
Yeah.
No, of course. Of course. Yeah. That's the deal for sure.
What do you guys think about, you ever see those skinless cats?
Oh yeah,
they're weird. Or skinless. Jesus Lord.
hairless.
You know what I meant. You know, the hairless ones.
Skinless cat.
You ever see those skinless cats? It's all.
I've seen them. Yeah.
It's just muscle and hair, man. No skin. Oh,
God. Yeah, the hair, the fur comes out of the muscle and the tendons and the it's very scary.
Oh man, my brain's melted. Yeah, those things are scary looking though. I had a student at Kent State that had one, and I'm like. I don't know. It's gross.
I would have one. I mean, it wouldn't be my preference, but I would do it.
So I had a friend of a friend that had one, and the cute thing about those is they get cold really easily because they don't have fur. So for one thing, they're really cuddly, and another thing, they wear cat sweaters in the winter. It's pretty cute.
So that's like it's not real cat fur, but if it was, that would be very weird, you know? Anyways.
Hey, so just to take us all the way back to the beginning here, Caleb, what's the best Tool album, do you think?
The best one is Lateralis. Lateralis. Okay. Am I saying that right?
I think it's
Lateralis. Now that I say it out loud, it sounds. Right.
What do you think, Bill?
I agree with Caleb. I think Lateralis is the best album.
Okay, both wrong, but that's okay. It's okay.
What's your favorite one?
It's the one right before it, Anima.
Oh, Anima. Well, Anima's great. It's a great album. It's got a lot of, like, you know, Stink Fist is a great song. 46 and 2 is great. And then the back half of it with, like, Third Eye is great. But it's not as complete of a... It's not as complete of, like, an experience as Lateralis is, I think, cover to cover.
I'm nervous about this new one because, of course, I'll get it. I'll enjoy it, I'm sure. But what did you say, 13 years?
It's been 13 years, since 10,000 Days.
Like, you can't possibly, you know, the expectation after that. And I don't know, you know, you hear people online, like, why does it take them so long? Da-da-da-da-da. It's like, well, I mean, yeah,
well,
they're
in fairness,
also doing other things. They haven't been working on this album for 13 years. It's not going to be 13 years good, you know.
I mean, I can kind of answer the reason for that is, I mean, yes, you know, like people like Maynard James Keenan, he was also fronting a band called Perfect Circle and Pucifer. Right. He had all these other things going on, too. I think the big reason they didn't release anything is because they had a contract dispute with their management and they were trying to get out of that.
Right.
And then also apparently the way they write their songs is the band writes the music first and then Maynard adds lyrics on top of that. And the band wasn't producing, so, you know, Maynard couldn't do anything until he, you know, got the music.
Have y'all listened to Fear Inoculum, the new tune?
Yeah.
It's great. I thought it sounded like good old Tool, like initial Tool.
Yeah, it definitely doesn't sound, so it doesn't have as many exotic time signatures as Lateralis does. It's a lot more straight ahead.
I thought... Go ahead, Casey. Sorry.
I was just going to say, Cameron, Ben, you're just going to have to wait it out. I'm sorry. You're just going to have to. It'll all be over in 3 minutes, I bet. Sorry, go ahead, Caleb.
But there was, I think it's the end of that tune that they're playing in like 5/4 or something, but then this guitar is like offset by an eighth note, and then Maynard starts singing this kind of longer melody, and it just feels so funky. Like it's all in five, but it has such a cool feel to it.
Well, that was one of my favorite things about the song Lateralis from the album Lateralis is it has a chorus that's in 9/8, 8/8, and then 7/8. And then it has a bridge instrumental portion that the basses and the vocals are in 6 and the drums are in 5 on top of it, which is super, super cool. It has that kind of swimming feel to it.
Yeah. It's funny how complicated they will be, but they won't be too complicated. I mean, there's certainly a lot of new bands that, oh man, it's way busier. It's way more complicated. It's, you know, like take a Meshuggah tune or something. And I mean, it's really, really challenging to figure out some of these other things, but I feel like Tool is just the right amount. You know, it's like, oh, it doesn't stress me out to try to figure out what it is. It's also interesting. The more complex music gets, the less, I guess, the less popular it gets. You know, I mean, Tool is pretty huge, but I think it goes over a lot of people's heads. You know, they literally like it's hard to latch on to these things because of like the, you know, polymetric things you described. And
it's hard to mosh in five. It makes it super hard.
It's hard to
get in a mosh pit in 5 or 7.
That's how
have you guys say it. Have you guys heard that prog rock tune, Blue Rondo a la Turk? It's in 9/8, 2/2, 2/3. And then it's 4/4, it's in 3/3/3. But a guy named Dave Brubeck. It's pretty cool.
That is cool.
Check that out.
Prog rock tune. Hey, well, I wanted to tell you guys one more thing that happened in music history on August 29th, and it is the premiere of a piece we've certainly talked about, and I don't think anybody, there's no such thing as a publication talking about anything modern that doesn't mention John Cage's 433. So 433 premiered in 1952 today when we're releasing the show, and is at something called the Maverick Concert Hall, Woodstock, New York. And it was met with lots of criticism, and everyone hated it and everything. And if you don't know what 433 is, and yeah, no judgment if you don't, but it's this really famous piece, and it's 4 minutes and 33 seconds of just silence. So the famous performance of the premiere, pianist came out, closed the piano lid, and watched the stopwatch, and opened the piano lid in the middle of to show the second movement, close the piano lid to show the next movement, etc. And the audience just listened to the sounds in the auditorium for 4 minutes and 33 seconds. And this piece is cited widely, widely, widely as, you know, the birth of modernism, the birth of conceptual music, and even the birth of noise music, which I don't really agree with that. But anyway, that's what people say. It's very, very hard to not see 433 talked about just all the time. And a lot of you probably knew a lot of that, but I was just going to add a few fun facts. The first being there is a 433 number 2. So I don't know if you guys have heard of 433 number 2, also called 000. So this is often referred to as 433 number 2. And the directions originally consisted of one sentence, which Cage says, in a situation provided with maximum amplification, perform a disciplined action. So, yeah, you can see a few performances of this out there. And he says, let's see, at the first performance, Cage had to write the sentence I just read, the description. And in the second performance, he added 4 new qualifiers to the directions. He says the performer should allow any interruptions of the action. The action should fulfill an obligation to others. The same action should not be used more than one performance and should not be a musical composition. So, yeah, you'll sometimes see that labeled 433 number 2, and you'll probably more commonly hear it named 000, so 0 minutes, 0 seconds. One other one is his piece titled 1/3. So here in this article, it says in late 1989, 3 years before his death, Cage revisited the idea of 433. He composed a piece titled 1/3, the full title of which is 1/3 equals 433 plus treble clef. I don't know what that's supposed to mean, but that's in the title. As in all his number pieces, the first one refers to the number of performers required, and the score instructs the performer to build a sound system in a concert hall so that, quote, the whole hall is on the edge of feedback without actually feeding back. The content of this piece is the electronically amplified sound of the hall and the audience. So I guess, and I've never seen a realization of this or ever even heard about it till now, but I guess the idea is that you'd have an array of speakers facing the audience, and you'd also have mics at the audience, and it would be, the mics would be just hot enough that the audience can hear itself, but it's not going to generate any feedback. Which sounds very hard to predict, because if the audience is going to just respond how they will, well, it'd be really hard to gauge when's the feedback going to start, you know, or how loud are they actually going to get. You need to like have a sense of that. So I would love to see that. That sounds like a really interesting idea to me. And I guess the solution would be we'll have someone at the soundboard and simply lower the mics if they start to get louder than expected or whatever. So yeah, we definitely cite 433 as like the first piece to do this, but there's actually a cool little list on Wikipedia of other silent pieces that we've had, and they've been in music and they've also been in theater. But I just copied and pasted a few that I thought were interesting. Alphonse Allais is a French composer in 1897 wrote this piece called Funeral March for the Obsequies of a Deaf Man, consisting of 24 blank measures. So this composer was an affiliate and friend of Eric Satie, and given Cage's profound admiration for Satie, people have wondered, well, okay, like, did you discover this 24 blank measures and maybe were inspired by that? And I guess Cage has been asked and said no, he wasn't aware of that, which is not surprising at all. I've never heard of this writer composer, and I actually have a little picture of it for you all, which I'll edit in, but I'll just show to you guys now. Anyway, and there's another one, Erwin Schulhoff's 1919 In Futurum, a movement from some piece for piano that I'm not going to dare pronounce, but this Czech composer meticulously notated a composition made up entirely of rest. So, and I'll overlay this too if you're watching on YouTube, but all these rests are very rhythmically prescribed, and they're in these very like detailed specific rhythms, but it's all rests. So I mean, there's nothing you do but interpret this, and I guess you, I don't know, can have performance gestures or something to match. Okay,
I heart reacted it. So.
Oh, good. Thank you. Yeah, that's
good. I have
good.
Seen that before though.
Have you really?
Surprisingly, yeah.
Well, there you go, man. It's a movement of complete silence, and it's in a piano solo from 1919. So it's interesting. And I don't know, I'm not trying to say, oh, this, you know, 433 is not a big deal because this stuff was done before. No, not at all. I mean, I don't think it's necessarily about doing it first. I mean, as we know, if someone was inventing something over in Europe, man, like Charles Ives was also doing it in the US. It's like, you know, it's like, did someone else do something new? Well, yeah, but Charles Ives also did it. It's like always the case. And the last one, in 1947, jazz musician Dave Tough, who wrote this book. I don't know if you guys have seen Dave Tough's parroted old book. It's out of print. It's a cool one. It's like a stick control, but it's all totally dedicated to paradiddles and inversions of paradiddles, da 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 da. It's a really neat book, I think. But in 1947, Dave Tough joked that he was writing a play in which, quote, a string quartet is playing the most advanced music ever written. It's made up entirely of rests. Suddenly the violist jumps up in a rage and shakes his bow at the first violin. Lout, he screams, you play that last measure wrong. So yeah. Anyway, people have been, I guess, toying with silence long before.
Yeah, I know that I wrote a research paper on John Cage at some point, and I was interested to find out that I think he was 18, I know he's the valedictorian of his high school class, and he proposed something called like the International Day of Silence or International Day of Listening or something like that. And the idea was, yeah, that we would listen to each other and be more in tune with the world. So that sounds like probably before he really got heavily into composition, he was already thinking about silence. So I would not be surprised if he was not aware of this, these other pieces mentioned.
Oh, sure. No, I bet he wasn't. And even if someone was going to try to say, oh, well, John Cage didn't do it first. Look at this. I mean, he has so many compositions that incorporate so much silence. I mean, there's so much silence in his previous pieces. That really long percussion solo, I forget the exact number, but it's like 23 minutes and da 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 da. I mean, it's like do this one little gesture and then you just wait and wait and wait, and then another little gesture and you wait and wait and wait. So yeah, I mean, he has all these pieces that use these very, very long silences that certainly amount to way more than 4 minutes and 33 seconds if you were to, you know, time them. So yeah, 4:33 premiered on August 29th.
I joke with my students, it was always my dream, if I was ever going to arrange a marching band show, I would make the ballad 4:33 and play it out in real time and have just the band do a scatter drill. I think that would get you some sweet points. How very, I don't know, cool. Blue Devils, what do you think? Would that be effective?
How very Blue Devils of you.
Did the Blue Devils do that?
They just do scatter forms always.
Oh.
But they still win, which is what's like terrible.
Well, I know a story. I mean, yeah, I don't know, trying to sneak in a John Cage. I know that some corps did Short Ride on a Fast Machine, which, of course, is a John Adams piece with the very iconic, like, constant woodblock. You know, there's a constant woodblock going. And supposedly one of the judges' comments was, hey, it was a great performance, but I really don't think you should have used the metronome.
It's like, no, man. Been there, yeah.
Right, yeah, Gockblock shouldn't have been there. It's like, yeah, sorry, dude, that's in the piece. Yeah, but what the heck do you even do? You're the director. You're going to go tell your kids, like, yeah, this is why we got marked off. This is why we didn't win, because the judges aren't as competent as I would like you all to think they are, you know? Ben, I think you had a question.
Yeah, so I've asked this sort of question fairly often to certain guests. And a lot of time when we think about young performers, we think about their teachers. And I'm almost astounded that we've actually gone through an entire hour here without mentioning the name Michael Burritt. Cameron is probably one of Michael Burritt's biggest name students at this point, for as far as recent graduates. So could you tell us about studying with Michael Burritt and what that experience was like?
Yeah. Burritt is crazy. I mean, we all kind of know him as like this like ball of energy. And the first time you meet him, man. I mean, it can be like, wow, you know, how does one human have so much energy? And it can be like intimidating and scary. But I think the first time I heard him talking, I studied with him a little bit before I auditioned there. And the first time I ever heard him like talk about some things, granted, I was a super naive person trying to take grad school auditions. It just blew me away. Like some of the stuff that he was saying, musically, that I had just never really thought about. So when I met him, it was like, oh my gosh, this guy has, you know, all this energy, but does, like, what's going on like behind the scenes, you know? And then you're astounded to find like how good of a musician that he is. And I also didn't realize that percussionists could be such good musicians, you know what I mean? So studying with him, man, it was a lot of like, it's a lot of pressure, I guess. And I felt like I never really was on top of my stuff. You come out the other side and you realize all the stuff you've learned. But when I was in the trenches, I didn't learn as much rep as I wanted. Felt like I was getting beat up. My first year at Eastman was really hard. And the second year when I started making progress, like professionally, I guess, you know, like that line between being a student and professional, that's when I started seeing more of the benefits of being there. And I loosened up a little bit, and I learned a lot from him. And some of the best lessons were him like jumping down my throat about stuff. You know, no, you're going to learn this piece because I told you you're going to learn it. Why this is unacceptable, or why are you talking so much in an ensemble rehearsal? Like, why are you talking, not talking back, but don't make excuses for what you're doing. Just listen to what I'm telling you and do it. Like, I don't need to hear your opinion about why you were playing something a certain way. It's a super hard pill to swallow for me. So I guess, sure. Yeah, those are some of the biggest lessons I learned. And the other thing is just that you get a guy like him that has so much energy and confidence and all this kind of stuff. And you can easily get swallowed up by that or take it the wrong way. And I think at the end of the day, you just need to realize that your professor, maybe not all of them have your best interest in mind, but damn, like Michael Burritt has your best interest in mind. And he really does care about all the students, which was an amazing lesson that it took me too long to accept, because you just want to fight back against a force like that, you know? Sometimes you want to fight back, so.
All right, well, thank you so much, everyone, for joining us today. Thank you also, Bill, Caleb, Casey, and especially Cameron Leach. We will see you on the next one.
Yeah, great to see you, Cameron.
Yeah.